welcome. My next door neighbour was his father was a church caretaker, and he was once asked what the capacity of the church was, to which he replied, "Well, it sleeps 400." So we haven't 400 this morning, but I think you'll find I'll do my very best for you. We're going to be reading from Numbers 5 in a couple of minutes, so you might want to have your finger there. I want to tell you a bit about a book that I read earlier this year. Hopefully we'll get a slide up of the book. And the book is about a number of legal cases that all involved this chap here, Jeremy Hutchinson, QC, who was widely regarded as one of the, if not the greatest, English criminal barristers of the 1960s, 70s and into the 80s. And the case studies are of trials that he participated in as a criminal barrister, mostly at the Old Bailey in London. The one I want to tell you about involves a painting, which is on the next slide, painted in 1892 by Francesco Goya of the victorious Duke of Wellington. This was painted in Madrid while he was on his sort of Peninsula War campaign. And in 1960, the painting was purchased at Sotheby's in London by an American art collector, Charles Reitzman, for the then astonishing sum of £140,000. Now, uproar ensued. Could such a national treasure be permitted to cross the Atlantic? Reitzman graciously agreed to sell the painting back to the nation at the price he had paid, and between them, the Wilson Foundation and the Treasury funded its purchase. So with considerable fanfare, on the 2nd of August 1961, the picture went on show at the National Gallery in London. Great. Well, not quite, because just 19 days later, the painting went missing. Dumbfounded security guards could offer no explanation, and there were no clues as to the painting's whereabouts. This was the first time a painting had been stolen from the National Gallery, and there was consternation at the very highest levels. The gallery's director offered his immediate resignation, and a reward of £5,000 was offered for the return of the painting. The newspapers reported that the investigation into the missing picture extended through Interpol across the world. Trains were stopped, ships were searched. Hundreds of people were interviewed. It was generally assumed that this was the work of a professional art thief. But then an anonymous letter was received by a newspaper demanding a donation of £140,000 to a charity, an amnesty for the perpetrator in exchange for the painting's return. This act, the letter said, is an attempt to pick the pockets of those who love art more than charity. The offer was declined, but there followed a number of further letters making similar demands. Public interest as to the whereabouts of the painting remained intense. The theft even hit the big screen, as we'll see in the next picture. This is a scene from Dr. No, made in 1962. James Bond is walking through his adversary's lair, encounters the picture propped up on an easel. Bond pauses and makes the trademark sort of Connery deadpan. So there it is. Sorry, I can't do the accent. Probably Jeff for that. Then the Daily Mirror's editor received anonymously a left luggage ticket issued at Birmingham New Street railway station. The Wellington picture was discovered there and swiftly returned to the National Gallery and its relieved director. The picture was back where it should be, but as to who had taken it, that remained a complete mystery. And then a few weeks later, on the 19th of July 1965, next slide please, this man, Kempton Bunton, who was named because apparently his father had a big win at the Kempton races, surrendered himself to the police and confessed to being the culprit. Now, Bunton was a 61-year-old retired Newcastle bus driver, and a figure about as far removed from the Dr. No type criminal mastermind as is possible to imagine. And he told the police that he was worried that after a few too many pints at his local, he had said too much about his guilt and involvement in the matter, and was worried someone would squeal on to the police and collect the £5,000 reward for themselves. And to stop that happening, he had decided to hand himself up. Well, the police were, perhaps not unsurprisingly, initially a tad reluctant to believe Mr. Bunton. Here was a man well into his middle age, upward of 6 feet tall and weighing in at more than 18 stones. How could he possibly have broken into the National Gallery unnoticed? But Bunton was insistent. He told the disbelieving officers that he had taken the painting as a protest against, and get this, the imposition on poor pensioners of a mandatory television licence fee. There is really nothing new under the sun. Unbelievable as it seemed, Bunton's story was supported by forensic scientists and fingerprint experts. His handwriting tests confirmed his authorship of the ransom notes, and his fingerprints were found on them. During a visit to the gallery, he had opened a window in a lavatory that he was then able to climb through the following morning, taking advantage of a ladder accidentally but conveniently left by workmen. While the guards were playing cards, he removed the painting still in its frame and made his escape out through the same window. Bunton's confession was leaked to the press, and he was soon being lionised as an example of that English underdog hero. The authorities, however, were not quite so awestruck by this unlikely star. Bunton was prosecuted for theft, making demands with menaces and causing a public nuisance. The trial was held at the Old Bailey in November 1965, and Jeremy Hutchison was his defence barrister. Now, we don't have time to go into the twists and turns of the trial, read the book, but it ended, despite his confession, with Bunton being acquitted by the jury of all charges, bar the theft of the picture's frame, which Bunton said he had left in a King's Cross boarding house 4 years earlier, and which he could not now locate. And to this day, the painting can be viewed in room 19 at the National Gallery in Trafalgar Square. So what's the connection between this story and Numbers 5? Well, it's simply this. Like the book about Jeremy Hutchison, Numbers 5 contains a number of case studies that look at different ways in which we might find ourselves guilty of breaking God's laws. So the question is this. Is it possible that we too could find ourselves a brilliant defence counsel who is able, in spite of our guilt and even a wholehearted confession to that guilt, to secure for us an acquittal of those charges? Case study one is in verses 1-4 of Numbers 5. The Lord said to Moses, command the Israelites to send away from the camp anyone who has a defiling skin disease or a discharge of any kind or is ceremonially unclean because of a dead body. Send away male and female alike. Send them outside the camp so that they will not defile their camp where I dwell among them. The Israelites did so. They sent them outside the camp. They did just as the Lord had instructed Moses. So at the heart of the book of Numbers is the dwelling of a holy God in the midst of his people. An unholy people who come into contact with a holy God will be consumed by his wrath. If they continue to be unholy, he must either abandon them or destroy them altogether. The way of life is necessarily the way of obedience to God's laws. They are not arbitrary, meaningless regulations given by an over-controlling deity who has nothing better to do with his time. They are rather the way to life and blessing, because life in all its fullness means living in the presence of God according to his law. It was possible for a person to contract ritual defilement in a number of ways in ancient Israel, and the rules are spelled out in much greater detail in Leviticus chapters 13 to 15. But in essence, the ritual impurities focused on four ways that brought a person into contact with the realm of death. The loss of bodily fluids, the discharge of bodily fluids, various wasting skin diseases, and contact with dead bodies. Well, contact with dead bodies self-evidently brought a person into contact with the realm of death. Equally, bodily fluids were associated with life, so their loss or emission moved a person from the realm of life into the realm of death. And skin diseases of the kind that withered and ate away the flesh were a kind of living death. The body was literally dying right in front of you. All such contact with the realm of death in the Old Testament meant being unfit for God's presence, and as a consequence, being sent outside the camp. Otherwise, such defilement would make it impossible for the living God to dwell in their midst. As we read the biblical passage about ritual defilement, maybe our instinctive reaction is to see this concern as superficial or unfair, even offensive. Why were these things regarded as important? To us, these laws may seem like a primitive taboo that has no relevance for today. But these laws were intended to reveal to us the profound depth of our problem as human beings, the significance of this defilement, picturing our alienation from God as enormous. Sin is much more than simply what we do or say or think. It is about our very nature as human beings in this world. The Bible shows us that thinking the only problem that stands between us and God is our behavior, is a superficial analysis. The issue, if the issue that makes us unfit to stand in God's presence is not simply an outward behavioral one, then our problem isn't simply bad chat or hanging out with the wrong crowd at school, and it isn't about those who cheat on their wives or rob banks or steal from the National Gallery who are alienated from God. Death is consuming our souls just as surely as leprosy devours the flesh. Left to myself, even the highest and holiest of human acts do not move me near to God, not even the guys who sold themselves into slavery. They keep me away from him. As Isaiah says, we have all become like one who is unclean, and all our righteous deeds are like a polluted garment. We all fade like a leaf, and our iniquities, like the wind, take us away. The very best things I do defile me and everyone with whom I have contact. And if that's true, then there's absolutely nothing I can do to make myself acceptable to God. I am by nature defiled and unclean, and I defile everything I touch, and I am unfit for God's presence. Of course, it's also true that my natural sinfulness works itself out in all sorts of particular sins for which I am also accountable, but my fundamental problem is deeper than that. Yet if the Old Testament picture shows us the depth of our alienation from God, the New Testament shows us the glorious answer to that alienation. The answer to the leper's cry, "Who will deliver me from this body of death?" is, "Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord." Jesus is the one who has come to deliver us from death and wash us clean. That is why we see Jesus in his earthly ministry, bringing into the covenant community those who under the old covenant had been excluded. The woman who had an emission of blood for many years and had tried in vain to find medical relief came to Jesus and touched him. From the perspective of the book of Numbers, that was fatal behavior, an unclean woman deliberately bringing herself into physical contact with the Holy One of Israel. No wonder Jesus stopped and demanded to know who had touched him. If she had touched anyone else, that person would have become unclean. But when she touches Jesus, he makes her clean. She who was once an outsider, alienated from God and his people, was now brought into the camp through the touch of Jesus. The part of the garment which Jesus was wearing and which the woman touched that hung down were called its wings, which helps us understand the prophecy about the Messiah in Malachi 4, and which is included in the Hark the Herald Angels carol. The Son of Righteousness shall rise with healing in his wings. Is it any wonder Jesus said to that woman, "Daughter, your faith has healed you, go in peace." The lepers too came to Jesus, and he touched them. He delivered them from their living death and told them to go and show themselves to a priest, just as the law required. And you'll notice that in neither case did Jesus dismiss the law as silly and outdated. Rather, in each situation, he dealt with the person's need by cleansing so they could enter God's presence. And this profound Old Testament picture of separation from God finds its answer in Jesus Christ. He came to take us from death and bring us into life. How? By taking upon himself the very exclusion from the presence of God that we deserved. He was taken outside the holy city of Jerusalem to be crucified, or, as Hebrews 13 puts it, outside the camp. He was cut off from fellowship with his Father. That is how he enabled our alienation from God to be dealt with, so that we might no longer be outsiders, forever excluded from God's presence, because of Jesus, a welcome into God's presence is available for us. Case study two. I should have asked Leslie to put there's a couple of bullet points anyway. So the first one was sin as unintentional ritual defilement. Second one is sin as a deliberate disobedience. And this is verses 5 to 10. The Lord said to Moses, say to the Israelites, any man or woman who wrongs another in any way and so is unfaithful to the Lord is guilty and must confess the sin they have committed. They must make full restitution for the wrong they have done, add a fifth of the value to it, and give it all to the person they have wronged. But if that person is no close relative to whom restitution can be made for the wrong, the restitution belongs to the Lord and must be given to the priest along with the ram with which atonement is made for the wrongdoer. All the sacred contributions the Israelites bring to a priest will belong to him. Sacred things belong to their owners, but what they give to the priest will belong to the priest. So the second case study is quite different from the first. It addresses a variety of potential sins that are quite deliberate. If our sin problem is much more than wrong thoughts and actions and words, it is certainly not less than that. Here, the exact nature of these sins is not explained in detail, but in the parallel passage in Leviticus 6 suggests that the most common issues these provisions related to involve theft by deception or misrepresentation. And in focusing our attention on sins as transgression, this passage reminds us that sin often has two dimensions. It is an offense against God and against other people. So dealing with it involves addressing those who have been affected. The first step in dealing with such sin is always confession, recognizing publicly that a wrong has been committed, verse 7, taking responsibility for our actions rather than trying to excuse them. And if, agreeing with God that those were wrong things that we have done, it's an important process of the process. It's an important part of the process of dealing with sin. But confession by itself was not enough, however. It was also accompanied by restitution of the full amount stolen plus 20%. The person who committed the sin not only had to say they were sorry, they also had to do what was in their power to put it right. If the damaged party was no longer alive, restitution could be paid to a close relative. If there was no relative, it was given to the Lord instead. In any event, justice could be seen to be done. And this is the situation that Zacchaeus finds himself in. Luke tells us about in chapter 9, you'll recall what Zacchaeus says when he meets Jesus. Stands up and says to the Lord, look, Lord, here and now I give half my possessions to the poor, and if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount. Half his possessions to the poor, not required by the law. And when it came to making restitution to those he had cheated, from, if my calculations are right, 15 times more repayment than the law required. I mean, I'd be getting a calculator out and working out to the sort of the last penny what I owed. Zacchaeus, 15 times more. What a testimony to the transformation Jesus can make. There is to be a putting right for the damage our transgressions do to those whom we have offended. But sin is not even primarily offense against other people. It is far more profoundly offense against God. Which is why after David committed adultery with Bathsheba and in effect had her husband Uriah murdered, he cried out, against you, you only have I sinned. David didn't mean that his sin had no impact on other people. Far from it. People had died as a result of his actions. Yet the most fundamental aspect of sin as transgression is the offense that it causes to a holy God. For that reason, in Numbers 5, after confession and restitution, sinners were required to offer a ram to make atonement for themselves. In this way, the fact that the offense was committed against the Lord was recognized publicly. If the sinner was not himself to die, someone or something must die in his place. This understanding of sin as a transgression reminds us that even after there has been confession and restitution, there still needs to be a sacrifice, the wages of sin or death. And those wages have to be paid either by the sinner or by someone else. This perspective too points us forward to Christ, the Lamb of God, who takes atonement, makes atonement for his people through his death on the cross. He is the atoning sacrifice for sin. He took our place in death to satisfy the justice of God, to overcome, to cover the offense that our sin causes to a holy God. When we sin, we too are to confess our sin, as John 1 reminds us. And when appropriate, we too are to make restitution to those hurt by our actions. As with Zacchaeus, the effect of grace on our lives is to make our hearts eager to do what is right. But of course, ultimately, it is not a confession or a restoration that saves, a restitution that saves us, but Christ's death in our place. To be honest with you, there's part of me was hoping that we'd run out of time before I got to case study 3, but you'll see why. And it's the final one, and it's verses 11 to 31. When the Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, if a man's wife goes astray and is unfaithful to him, so that another man has sexual relations with her, and this is hidden from her husband, and her impurity is undetected, since there is no witness against her, and since she has not been caught in the act, and if feelings of jealousy come over her husband, and he suspects his wife, and she is impure, or if he is jealous and suspects her, even though she is not impure, then he is to take his wife to the priest. He must also take an offering of a tenth of an ephah of barley flour on her behalf. He must not pour olive oil on it or put incense on it, because it is a grain offering for jealousy, a reminder offering to draw attention to wrongdoing. The priest shall bring her and make her stand before the Lord. Then he shall take some holy water in a jar of clay and put some dust from the tabernacle floor into the water. After the priest has made the woman stand before the Lord, he shall loosen her hair and place in her hands the reminder offering, the grain offering for jealousy, which he himself holds, the bitter water that brings a curse. Then the priest shall put the woman under oath and say to her, if no other man has had sexual relations with you, and you have not gone astray and become impure while married to your husband, may this bitter water that brings a curse not harm you. But if you have gone astray while married to your husband, and you have made yourself impure, having sexual relations with a man other than your husband, here the priest is to put the woman under his curse. May the Lord cause you to become a curse among your people when he makes your womb miscarry and your abdomen swell. May this water that brings a curse enter your body so that your abdomen swells or your womb miscarries." And the woman is to say, "Amen, so be it." The priest is to write these curses on a scroll and then wash them off into the bitter water. He shall make the woman drink the bitter water that brings a curse, and this water that brings a curse and causes bitter suffering will enter her. The priest is to take from her hands the grain offering for jealousy, wave it before the Lord, and bring it to the altar. The priest is then to take a handful of the grain offering as a memorial offering and burn it on the altar. After that, he is to make the woman drink the water. If she has made herself impure and been unfaithful to her husband, this will be the result. When she is made to drink the water that brings a curse and causes bitter suffering, it will enter her. Her abdomen will swell and her womb will miscarry, and she will become a curse. If, however, the woman has not made herself impure but is clean, she will clear it of guilt and will be able to have children. This then is the law of jealousy: when a woman goes astray and makes herself impure while married to her husband, or when feelings of jealousy come over a man because he suspects his wife, the priest is to make her stand before the Lord and is to apply this entire law to her. Her husband will be innocent of every wrongdoing, but the woman will bear the consequences of her sin. As we've just seen, most of this chapter is taken up with the third case study, the woman who is suspected of marital unfaithfulness. There was no proof of her guilt or innocence, only the suspicion that she had been unfaithful. To deal with this situation, she was subjected to what may seem to be to us a bizarre and primitive ritual. What on earth is going on here? And why does this particular offence attract such an extensive description at this point in the book of Numbers? The answer, I think, is to see here that we have a third picture of sin, which is sin as unfaithfulness. Since marriage is the key metaphor for the relationship between God and Israel, it is not surprising that adultery then becomes the key metaphor for breaches in that relationship. Whenever Israel went after idols and were at the same time being untrue to her husband, the Lord. So how was Israel to deal with the situation where a wife was suspected of such a serious breach while there was no conclusive proof? The answer is that they were to take the matter to the Lord and leave judgment in his hands. When he brought the charge against his wife, the husband was also to bring a grain offering. The word for grain offering was elsewhere used of gifts given as a mark of submission to a superior. So in bringing a grain offering, there was an act of submission to the Lord. The grain offering, however, was devoid of all the usual markers of joy that would be offered with it, oil and incense, because there was no joy in this situation. The woman stood before the Lord with her hair broken, a symbol of the potential broken marriage covenant. And then the priest was to charge the woman with an oath, a self-imposed curse. He said, in essence, if you have been unfaithful, then let this water not cause you harm. But if you have been unfaithful, then may you become barren. And the woman was to respond with the words, "Amen, so be it." If she was guilty, the Lord would impose the curse that she had called down upon herself. If she was innocent, the curse would have no effect and she would continue to live a normal, fruitful life. There was nothing in the water or the ink or the dust that could harm her. If she were an adulteress, only God could bring about the curse upon her. It was an act of faith on the part of the woman and the community, placing judgment into the hands of God, who sees the unseen rather than in the hands of a man. And unlike apparently similar rituals that existed in the ancient world, it didn't presume the woman's guilt. She wasn't thrown into the river to see whether she would drown or not. The procedure protected the innocent against unfounded charges as much as it brought the guilty to the bar of justice. An adulterous wife would experience God's curse for her unfaithfulness, while the innocent wife would emerge vindicated. So, if adulterous wives were certain to receive God's curse, even in the absence of compelling human testimony, what will God do with his own adulterous wife, Israel? In Israel's case, there was no doubt as to her guilt. The prophets repeatedly tell of Israel's long history of spiritual unfaithfulness to God. So what would happen to her? The answer is that God himself, the jealous husband, will bring her to trial and make her drink the cup of God's wrath. Isaiah 51, Ezekiel 23, we see God giving his unfaithful bride a bitter cup to swallow, a cup full of lamentation and woe. Since she is self-evidently guilty, how will she escape when she drinks the cup? Will she not feel the full force of God's curse upon her? Will her reproductive power not be cut off so that she can bear no more children? Well, the answer is yes and no. Yes, Israel was forced to drain the bitter cup to its dregs at the time of the exile. She faced the punishment of exile and death of a whole generation away from the promised land. Yet that was not the end of the story. God rescued her from exile and brought her back to her own land. He went after his unfaithful wife. He wooed her back. So does God have double standards, hard on human adultery, but soft on spiritual adultery? By no means. God was able to go after his wayward wife and bring her back because Jesus would take up the bitter cup of judgment and drain it in the place of his bride, the church, the new Israel. His curse for my blessing, his death for my life. Jesus is the answer to the plight of the guilty adulterous wife, each of us. Isaiah 53 draws all three of these pictures of sin and their remedies together in the experience of the suffering servant. He was cut off from the land of the living for our sake. His life was our guilt offering. And who can speak of his descendants? He was pierced for our transgressions and cursed for our iniquities. Yet the result of his bearing the curse is that he will see his offspring and prolong his days. Jesus is the one who has dealt with our sin. And so we are able to come into God's holy presence and there to find mercy and grace sufficient for our needs. To him alone, glory.